Good day, and welcome to the 21st presentation of Inside the Beltway by Drinker Riddle. Now I would like to turn the conference over to Fred Riche. Please go ahead.
Kayla, thank you very much. And hello, everybody. It's good morning from the West Coast and good afternoon on the East Coast. I think we have an interesting program for you today. But first, let me start with the introductions. I'm Fred Riche, and I'm the head of the Drinker Riddle practice area called Financial Institution Services or Financial Services ERISA practice. The concept there is that we represent broker-dealers, RIAs, insurance companies, banks and trust companies, and other service providers to retirement plans, which is a type of ERISA practice, but a little bit different than what attorneys do who represent plan sponsors. With me is Brad Campbell, a partner in our Washington, D.C. office. And Brad is also an ERISA attorney and part of that team, but more importantly, in a sense, is that he's a former assistant secretary at the Department of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration. So he's seen what it looks like and how it works from inside the Department of Labor. Also with me is Sandy Granum, who is the head of our FINRA practice group and as both a compliance area and as a litigator. And I think Sandy will give us some valuable insights into potential claims under the expanded fiduciary rule. And I've got Jim Dolan from Natixis with me, but I'll say a little more about Jim in a minute. I want to mention first that this presentation is being recorded, as the operator said, and that the recording will be posted on our website in a few days. So it will be posted at www.drinkerbiddle.com under the heading of Insights and Events, or the tab Insights and Events. But we email all of the registrants as soon as it's posted with a link. So as long as you registered, which I assume you have, then you don't have to worry. We'll email you with that. Now let me speak about Jim Dolan. Jim is the Vice President for Retirement Strategies at Natixis, which for a considerable period of time has sponsored this call and allowed us to bring it to you. So I want to introduce Jim, but I also want to say thanks to Jim and thanks to Natixis. Jim?
Thanks so much, Fred. Appreciate it. We're really grateful for the partnership. And as you mentioned, this has been a partnership over probably 3 or 4 years, and this is our 21st session of Inside the Beltway, so we're grateful to be able to bring this and provide your great insights. Wanted to thank Drinker Biddle. I want to thank everyone for calling in today. And I just want to take a moment and tell you a little bit about Natixis, if you're not familiar. So we're a multi-affiliate organization across fixed income equities alternatives, recognized by Barron's as a top mutual fund family for 2016, which is great. And I also wanted to share with you our focus on retirement and engaging participants. We've recently launched the Sustainable Future Funds, which is an ESG mutual fund target date series. It's the first in the industry, and we think it's a great way to get participants more engaged and to align their investments with their values. So I want to thank Fred, I want to thank Brad, and I want to thank Sandy for the call today. And again, thank you, everyone, for calling in.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks very much. Well, let's jump right into the deep end of the pool. It's been 3 months, more or less, since our last call. And it's hard to believe, in hindsight, how much has gone on in that three-month period. For example, the Secretary of Labor, Secretary Acosta, made the decision to allow the fiduciary rule to be applicable and transition exemptions to be applicable on June 9th rather than April 10th. But nonetheless, the day is coming on, and they apply now. Also, on June 1st, the chair of the SEC issued a series of questions and indicated that he and the SEC commissioners would be interested in collaborating with the DOL on the rewriting, reconsideration of the fiduciary rule and conflicts of interest. And then the Department of Labor has issued an RFI with a number of questions about the fiduciary rule, but mainly about the exemptions. But that's just a 50,000-foot level overview. Let me turn it over to Brad to bring you up to date with a little more detail. Brad?
Well, thanks, Fred, and thanks again to all of you for tuning in. another way to put what Fred just said is that the fiduciary rule has ruined yet another summer for all of us in terms of the amount of work and activity that's going on. And that's exactly where we are right now. As Fred said, the Labor Department, I kind of view it on the fiduciary rule that we have two tracks running with respect to the Labor Department. We have the implementation issues related to the rule becoming applicable on June 9th. And since the rule was put in but for the transition exemptions, word for word as the Obama administration wrote it, the concerns and questions and implementation issues that were never resolved are still not resolved. So we're operating in a period right now where the rule applies in significant part, and that presents some compliance challenges and things people need to work through. That's one track. The other track is the regulatory side, which is the Department of Labor has begun a regulatory process to consider changing the rule. As part of President Trump's order to review the rule, the department put out a request for information, which has two separate timelines for response. The first timeline, the 15-day comment, which is due tomorrow, for those of you working on those, Friday the 21st, that comment period deals with question one of the RFI, which is solely about extending the transition period. Because right now, on January 1 of 2018, roughly 5 months from now, the full BIC exemption, the full scope of the rule, will otherwise come into effect. And so this first round of comments due tomorrow deals with whether that should be extended and what the costs and benefits to retirees, to retirement savers would be from that. The second comment period deals with all of the other substantive issues, the other questions 2 through 18 of the RFI, and that's currently due on August 7th is when the 30-day comment ends. The Labor Department just recently put out on its webpage, but without any other fanfare, a notice that they would consider comments received after these deadlines, at least until a certain point when events had moved beyond their ability to consider them, which one way to think of that is when they actually send a proposal over to the White House for review, presumably that's when it will be too late for them to consider comments. So it appears that they have decided not to formally extend the comment period, but to informally agree to accept some comments after the deadline. But for all of those working on it, I think that means we still need to focus on August 7th is the deadline for that. All of that information is to be used by the Labor Department to decide whether to rescind, modify, or leave the same the rule, and, of course, whether to extend the transition period. My assumption, and I think those of most observers, is that because the Labor Department is looking to coordinate with the SEC, because the Labor Department could not finish its review and propose a new regulation to change the rule, before January 1, that it's quite likely the extension, this transition period, will be extended, though we don't know by how much or how long. And I think it's also likely that they'll be moving very quickly to do that, that we should anticipate a proposal to extend the transition period, probably late August, early September, somewhere in there, because if you work backwards for the amount of time it takes for a rule to be finalized, get comments and all of that, that's probably how quickly they would need to move on that. So I think most of us think that there will be an extension of the transition period, and then that leaves the question of what will happen with the substantive rule, what will the time frame there be, what changes are coming. There's a separate round of consideration going on in Congress, particularly in the House of Representatives. There's several different bills that have moved either through the House or through their committees that would either kill the DOL rule or replace it, kill it and then replace it with new standards. The Education of the Workforce Committee just marked up such a bill yesterday. So there's activity in Congress as well on this issue. I think most of us looking at it would say the House can probably pass whichever versions it chooses to pass, but it's not so clear that things will get through the Senate. So I think focusing on that, probably most of the long-term action is probably going to be through the Labor Department and what's going on with that process. The last component is the ongoing litigation against the rule. There's been some movement there. The Labor Department is still, via the Department of Justice, defending that the rule was properly promulgated, even as it's separately working a process to potentially amend the rule itself. So the litigation proceeds And we'll sort of see how all that ends up. So you add all that together, there's a lot of different things moving with a lot of short-term deadlines. And I think the thing to remember is this comment period is going to be a vital part of this fight. We need to make sure that by roughly August 7th, we've gotten every issue that we want to bring up to the department in a comment letter and brought up so that it can be considered as part of the department's efforts to review the rule and decide what they want to do next. Brad, anything you want to add to that?
No, let me ask you one question, though, Brad. There have been comments in the media about the DOL and the SEC collaborating on this. What are you hearing inside the Beltway about that? Are they collaborating? Is anything going on?
Yeah, they have been, and I think this is, in general, a very encouraging step forward, because I think there's two different issues. One is, are they collaborating in the sense of trying to get sort of uniform answers so that there isn't a DOL answer and a separate fiduciary unrelated SEC standard answer? Or are they looking to come up with kind of a more uniform approach? That's one. The other is just, are they coordinating enough to make sure that whatever they separately come up with doesn't conflict and that there's enough time for all the other associated regulatory changes that might be necessary from the SEC to allow reasonable responses to the rule? In other words, approve innovations in product designs and so forth. I think both of those are going on right now. It's just not clear how long that might take or where we're going to end up. There's no question, though, that both Secretary Acosta and Chair Clayton are committed personally to trying to work this through together. I just think it's a little early to predict whether that's going to work and how it's going to manifest itself.
Good. Well, anyway, that at least the goal is to not have inconsistent rules so that there would be inherent conflicts. In other words, almost impossible to comply. With that introduction and that overview of where we are now, and particularly focusing on the fact that the fiduciary rule became applicable on June 9th, and therefore all advice to plans and IRAs and participants and rollover advice and transfer of IRAs advice, distribution advice, all of that is now a fiduciary act, meaning that the service providers who become fiduciaries have to comply with a new set of rules. Sandy, what are you seeing in terms of your clients, in terms of steps to comply or steps to avoid liability? What kinds of things do you see in the broker-dealer community?
Well, you know, what Brad hit the nail on the head. You know, the consistency of standards is really the essence of the problem, at least at the broker-dealer level, because they were not necessarily investment advisors before. So you could have a broker who had a common law right of fiduciary duty under certain circumstances and no fiduciary duty under others. So in the brokerage industry, and I think part of the problem that sort of began with the Obama administration saying find a solution for retirement accounts was the fact that the general public was confused by who had a fiduciary responsibility and who didn't. So you had, in most states, plain vanilla accounts like an individual investment account where there would be no fiduciary responsibility without some extraordinary relationship. You had advisory accounts, which were covered by the 40 Act, which had a level of fiduciary duty, but usually it was a disclosure requirement. And now, with this new rule, all retirement accounts, IRAs and 401ks, would have what was in essence an ERISA standard of fiduciary duty. So presently, since June 9th, 2017, there are three standards now, and even more reason why the public might be confused. So for the last year, the broker-dealers have been trying to institute educational proceedings, policies for their brokers to educate them on what the various standards would be, have communications with their clients to establish their new fiduciary standing with regard to retirement accounts, and set into place platforms and compensation policies that would abide by what we all thought was going to be the new DOL rule. And there's been a lot of activity and money spent and intellectual capital on that, which may or may not actually come to pass in January 2018. So, you know, it's gone from everything to broker education to developing new mutual fund shares to determining what is appropriate for trips and other incentives for brokers, whether, you know, there can be purchases of broker books. And so it's really been soup to nuts.
Hello?
Yes. So it's been a pretty extensive endeavor on the part of the broker-dealers.
Yeah, Fred, this is Brad. I would just sort of back that up by saying we've certainly seen that as well in clients other than broker-dealers, kind of across the board. This has resulted in a lot of changes. And for the June 9th, you know, this transition period, most of the changes, I think, have centered on how do we put in place the right process and documentation about gathering the information necessary to develop a recommendation and training our staff on how to use that, how to collect the data, how to develop recommendations that are consistent with that standard. This transition period has allowed us to defer some of the more difficult questions on how to restructure products and compensation because while the fiduciary standard applies, the transition exemptions are easier to contend with in terms of some of the systems and structures that need to be put in place. And that's partly why I think this transition period is such an important first question. It would be extremely disruptive for retirement savers to have June 9th happen with all of the changes that resulted there, accounts that are now closed to new advice. A lot of different, literally millions of people have received notices that change how their IRAs work and what services they can get. To then have, again, January 1, a huge wave of change associated with the implementation of the full BIC exemption, full prohibited transaction 8424 changes, and then to have yet another wave of change, assuming the Labor Department decides that it wants to substantively amend the rules, would just be very disruptive. So I think that's part of the reason I think, and I'm optimistic, that we will see an extension of the transition period to avoid that intermediate step of further disruptive change.
Along the same line, Fred, I think that the transition period now is essential if there really is going to be a coordination between the SEC and the Department of Labor to come up with some kind of uniformity in standards. Because, as Brad said, if there's yet another change and then the SEC comes out with a standard that applies to accounts other than retirement accounts or a standard which conflicts with the standards being applied to retirement accounts, it seems yet more confusion in the marketplace.
Yeah, you know, going back to one thing Brad said, something I've heard from several broker-dealers is that that they have to train their advisors to better document their process for developing recommendations. And I think going into it, I would not have suspected that as being an issue, but it seems to be emerging as a fairly significant issue, that it's just enough of a different way of doing business in terms of the process for developing and delivering recommendations to be a fiduciary versus a broker, that it does present some issues. And there's going to be a lot of education and along the way, and then a lot of re-educating as people learn where the problems are, where the deficiencies are. Let me segue over to investment advisors, RIAs, and some of the issues I see there. I've been surprised lately. I've gotten calls from several RIA firms that don't do a lot of retirement plan work. In fact, do very little. And so some of these concepts are new to them as well. Now, they're already fiduciaries, but this is a more stringent fiduciary standard. And the conflict of rules here are absolute rather than disclosure. Helping an advisor comply, disclosure can actually be an admission of wrongdoing under the prohibited transaction rules. So where do I see that come up as a real problem? Well, one area, under BICE, the best interest contract exemption, if you give advice about securities and you receive some additional compensation, so long as the compensation is reasonable, the transition BICE rule says that's okay for the RIA to receive that. The problem that I'm seeing, though, is that the RIAs that are calling me that don't do a lot of ERISA work don't realize that BICE only applies to non-discretionary accounts. So if they're managing IRAs on a discretionary basis, and they're thinking that they can receive those additional payments, those are prohibited transactions. It's not permitted. Although for non-discretionary investment advice, it would be. So there is a distinction between discretionary investment management, which does not have BICE available. It's got a few other prohibited transaction exemptions, but they're not very broad, versus non-discretionary investment advice, where BICE is applicable and gives a tremendous amount of relief. And we're talking about transition BICE now, unless we say otherwise. So discretionary accounts are one area where I'm seeing problems. I'm worried, based on the conversations I'm having with some people, that folks don't get the rigorous review that's required to recommend a rollover. You have to have information about the plan that the participant's in, the investments, the services, and the expenses, and then you have to compare that to the rollover IRA, investments, services, and expenses, and do a best interest recommendation based on an unbiased evaluation. That's one area. I just don't know that people are gathering all the data they need to gather to do that. The other area about rollovers that bothers me is that the rules say that in doing that analysis, the advisor has to take into account the other options, like transferring to the plan of a new employer and taking a taxable distribution. There are essentially four options. And I don't see some people, taking into account those other two options, transferring to the plan of a new employer or taking a taxable distribution. And then the last area that I'll mention right now is two areas. One is rollover services, where you recommend that somebody transfer an IRA, rollover an IRA. Again, that's that same kind of vetting. You have to get information about the investment, services, and expenses at the least in the old IRA, and then compare them to the new IRA, and then make an unbiased best interest recommendation. So I'm worried that while people who do retirement plan work and go and participate on conference calls like this get it, I'm worried that there's a lot of advisors out there that don't get it yet. They don't understand how rigorous it is, or maybe they don't even know about the rule. And then finally, fiduciary training. I think fiduciary education is really important. But in the sense of understanding that it's a process-driven thing, that it involves asset allocation, modern portfolio theory, generally accepted investment principles, and so on, I'm worried, and the documentation that I mentioned earlier, I'm worried that all of that is not necessarily baked in the cake. Brad, back to you, or Sandy for that matter, any thoughts about RIAs that you would want to add to that?
Well, the one thing I would add to that is I think also people need to remember the way DOL set it up. Advice to roll into the new employer's 401k is also fiduciary advice, which means if you know, you can't casually provide consolidation recommendations, as I think a lot of people have in the past, that now would have to be a full review of the plan the money's coming from, the plan the money's going into, to then make a recommendation about whether it's in their best interest or not. And I don't know that that's frankly realistic for most cases where people are starting out with a new employer and the question is should they roll over. So I think that's one issue. Another is I think the fiduciary, if you recommend a distribution and DOL includes RMDs as recommending a distribution, required minimum distributions, that is now considered fiduciary advice. So if you tell someone to use the money from their upcoming RMD to invest in something else, DOL's viewing that as a fiduciary recommendation. So I think there's a number of these problem areas that are tripping up everybody, not just RIAs or broker-dealers, but kind of the whole industry, life insurance folks, insurance recommendations across the board. This is a problem where the scope is so much broader than I think a lot of people, as you say, who weren't already steeped in sort of ERISA and retirement issues, the scope is so much broader than I think a lot of people realize. And that's part of what I meant when I said there's existing problems with the fiduciary standard as promulgated by the Obama administration that really have not yet been addressed. So these are all issues hopefully will get fixed in the next go-around, but in between, in the transition period, we still have to be aware of these and work through on doing so. But I'll point out that is where we have some protection in that the Labor Department and the IRS is going along with that as well, has an enforcement policy that says if you're working diligently and in good faith, they won't pursue you for mistakes that happen. So you know, if you haven't been doing some of these things that are fiduciary since June 9th, if we can work on fixing them now, then you're probably going to be all right, at least from a federal enforcement perspective. Obviously, that doesn't apply to private litigation or, you know, other types of investigations.
And I think that is the essence of the problem, because while the regulators can say we're holding off until we get our ducks in order, just abide by the rule in good faith, it doesn't stop a private litigant from saying this is the rule. And while it might not be being enforced by the Department of Labor or the IRS, it does, on the records, it says that you have a duty to us that you have failed to live up to. And so there is a worry on the street that it will, in, you know, it will invoke litigation in this sort of transitional period of time based upon these standards that are being applied.
Now, Sandy, while we're at this point, let me just ask you what you think some of those claims might be. I would guess the best interest standard of care, but where do you see claims coming up? What do you think about that?
Well, it's only been a minute, literally, since the June 9th trigger date, but almost immediately thereafter, I saw a claim that discussed the breach of fiduciary duty in very DOL fiduciary duty rule terms, failing to have the best interest standard, but it was not a retirement account, which is always what we have been fearful of, that once you establish a fiduciary duty that's different from the other accounts that are being managed by the broker-dealer, it'll be difficult not only for the client to distinguish what the duty is from account to account, but it's unlikely that their attorneys are going to distinguish from account to account when they bring suits. So what would, you know, in the particular case I'm thinking of, there was even a reference to the Financial Advisors and Investment Salesperson article that was written by a Financial Services Council, Consumer Federation of America, that specifically had to do with retirement accounts, but the litigation I'm thinking of did not have to do with a retirement account. And so that's one of the fears that the industry has, is we'll be exposed to this new standard, and there'll be, just because there isn't truly a legitimate cause of action there, doesn't mean that you're not going to be faced with the litigation. And litigation is an odd thing in the securities industry. The more confusing the issue is, the less likely you are to win, because if the arbitrators can't figure out what the issues are, then there's no way the customer, they will believe, could figure out what the issues are.
Now, you know, generally under the prohibited transaction rules, these prohibited transaction rules, the amount of the loss is the compensation paid to the broker-dealer and the advisor or to the RIA firm. So, you know, being sued to restore your compensation is not typically a large lawsuit. But so the area that I really worry about more than anything is people who don't follow the rollover procedures, because the money rolls over into an IRA, but the employee no longer works at that company. So you can't very well roll it back to correct the prohibited transaction. In other words, that participant has lost the advantage of those high-quality, low-cost plan investments forever. I could see a pretty big claim, and possibly including investment losses, built around the best interest standard of care in that case. So of all of them, that's the one that, in my mind, has the potential to produce some of the largest damages when you come to talking about IRAs. So if I had to bet on something I was worried about, that would be it. Before I move on, I also want to point out that there are some services out there that are being developed to help with this. Fee benchmarking, for those of you who do 401k work, you know that we've had fee benchmarking forever there. However, now that's extending to individual variable annuities and all types of annuities, advised accounts, non-discretionary advice to IRAs, discretionary management of IRAs, on and on and on. There will be all kinds of fee benchmarking services to help you with the reasonable compensation issue. Also, there are going to be rollover services that are quite sophisticated and that help assemble the information needed about the old plan and the new IRA and and help with the analytical process by prioritizing the needs and circumstances of the investor. So it would be a software package, but also assistance with the gathering and input of the information. And then finally, with fiduciary training, we're working with clients that are service providers that are doing all of these things. So all of this is going to be readily available, and I believe at a reasonable cost to help people comply with these rules. Sandy and Brad, do you want to add anything about other developments that you're seeing that will be helpful down the road, or at least have the potential?
Well, one thing I would just clarify, because you know, prior to this fiduciary rule, we had a big gray area for rollovers where the advisor was a fiduciary to the plan the rollover was coming from. DOL had said it may be a prohibited transaction, literally, that it may be, not that it was or it wasn't. So, and there was no clear exemption applicable. You know, one sort of bright spot here is that for folks who are fiduciaries to plans, there now is a clear path for giving rollover advice, a clear exemption to use to do so. And to Fred's point, as while there are services emerging to help gather the information, obviously if you're the advisor to the plan, you have sort of the inside track on getting that information already. So for advisors who have been fiduciaries and have kind of been avoiding the rollover marketplace or personal wealth management, it's creating some new opportunities. And I've been seeing a number of entities thinking about what additional services could they provide, what could they add on to do more business in the rollover space rather than less. So there's been some interesting innovations, I think, and results where this rule has cut different directions than DOL might have anticipated.
You know, on that line, though, the parallel between a plan and an IRA becomes problematic. For instance, a broker who's handling his own IRA or handling the IRA of a family member and then becomes an interested person. Is he getting a commission for handling his own IRA? Is he getting a commission for handling his wife's IRA? Does that become prohibited? Is it distributions from the IRA that's paying his income? So when it's looked at on a plan scale where it sort of makes sense on the individual retirement account scale, it doesn't make as much sense.
I think that's a good example of where we have both ERISA and securities regulation issues that have been changed that the realities have been changed as a result of this rule, and we're still sort of feeling our way through how to deal with some of those.
Yeah, Brad, as you going back to where you were a little earlier when you were talking about the applicability date, could you look at your crystal ball for us and give us at least a rough idea of what you think will be the extended applicability date, of what will be the ultimate effective date of any changes, of how long we're going to operate the way we are now. And if you have a few thoughts about what some of those changes might be, like the class action provision, why don't you tell us about that?
Okay. Yeah, let me look into my crystal ball and very clearly state that I'm now making predictions that are worth what you're paying for them, listener. But the reality, I think, as I said, is I think we will see. Of course, DOL hasn't made a decision on any of this yet. The comment period's still open. But I think the reality is they will extend the transition period. And I'm hopeful they'll do it by a year at least. I think people are calling for that or longer. But I think that is a reasonable amount of time necessary to gather the data, to do the review the president has ordered, to work with the SEC and FINRA and the state insurance commissioners and everybody else to try and develop a better product in terms of a final rule. And so I think a year is sort of the minimum you would really need to be able to do all that work. So I think DOL will do an extension. I hope it's a year. And I think they will do it relatively soon, because I don't think DOL wants to repeat the experiences we had in April, where they had to start answering questions about what happens if we delay the effective date after the applicability of the effective date. And even as it was, we got, on April 7th, a rule delaying an April 10th deadline. I think DOL wants to avoid that because of the amount of work that will otherwise have to be done to comply with the full BIC exemption, the changes to 8424 that will otherwise take effect on January 1. So I think they're going to try to be a few months ahead of that in issuing a final rule delaying you know, extending the transition period. So I think we'll see that move on a fast track. I think we'll see a proposal soon, and we'll see that be resolved quickly. I don't think it's clear what the timeline is going to be on the substantive changes to the rule, or necessarily on what all those changes are. I think, you know, you alluded to the BIC exemption and the class action lawsuit provisions there. I do think that's on DOL's radar as a serious issue. If I were going to guess, I would say changing the BIC exemption to remove the the class action lawsuit provision is probably pretty high as a priority for the department because of all the trouble that's going to cause, for retirement investors, for all of us, and in fact for the department. I think you'll end up with a very odd result if county judges in Mississippi, Alabama, Texas, and wherever all start taking their own interpretations of what the new fiduciary standards are and then applying them with their state contract laws, and you're going to end up with some very potentially, you know, very bizarre and potentially contradictory results, which will make it very difficult to administer sort of any sort of uniform standards. So I think for DOL's own internal purposes, it would not be well served to have all these conflicting interpretations. So I'm hopeful that those kind of provisions will come out. Beyond that, as I've said on past calls, we need to treat this comment period that's open right now as if it's 2015 again, and we are relitigating every issue. Every issue that matters to all of you out there about what the rules should look like, what the exemption should look like, needs to be in this comment letter due by August 7th. We need to give DOL clear answers to where the problems are, clear data about the effect those problems have already been having, and clear answers about how to fix those problems. And if it's not in this RFI, it's going to be very hard to fight about it later, because DOL is taking a very by-the-book, dotting their I's, crossing their T's approach to the regulatory process. So treat this comment period seriously, make all those arguments, and I think then we'll have a chance to have some hopefully pretty good changes come out of this process. But if we don't do the work on the front end, it's going to be hard to get the result out of the back end.
Yeah, Brad, if I add all those things together date-wise, I could see a scenario where the transition rule would be extended for 1 year from January 1, 2018 to January 1, 2019. And then I could see where once the final rules are issued, that people would be given a year, maybe all the way to January 1, 2020, to comply with the new rules, meaning that the transition rules would stay in effect for that additional time. Do you think that's just out of the question, or is what I just said plausible?
I think it's plausible. I mean, we'll have to make all those arguments. But if, for example, let's say it is extended, the transition period's extended for 1 year while they work on the rules. And so let's say it's now applicable, not this coming January, but the January after. And they don't finish working on the regulation with a new set of final rules until, you know, September of next year. So realistically, there's no way they could implement significant changes with just 3 months to go. So I think it would make sense, and I think a lot of us are already suggesting to DOL that if you're going to make substantive amendments, that we need at least a year delay on the transition rule now, and you should provide a further year to implement whatever substantive changes you ultimately might make. So it's sort of a later of 1 year or a year from your final answer. And I think that would really be the responsible way to do this, because if they make a lot of substantive changes, that's going to require a lot of work to implement. And part of the reason this rule has been so problematic is not just its, in my opinion, many bad policy decisions, but also the fact that there's been a rush to implementation that was not realistic given the scope of the changes provided. And I don't think the Trump administration, which has, you know, talked significantly about efficient regulation, is as likely to push an answer unnecessarily quickly when that's going to result in more dislocation and confusion.
So, you know, the securities laws and ERISA, the securities law on one hand and ERISA and the Internal Revenue Code on the other for qualified, treat conflicts of interest differently. Under the securities laws and FINRA, you can disclose in most cases. Under ERISA and the Internal Revenue Code, unless there's a specific exemption, you can't. Disclosure doesn't cure anything. So because of the different statutory structures, let's set that conflict of interest issue aside for a moment, and let's just talk about the standard of care. You know, under the fiduciary rule and the new best interest standard, which is almost verbatim the same as the fiduciary rule, it is a standard of care that generally requires that the advisor or the financial institution engage in a prudent process to develop recommendation. So you have that, and then you have the SEC fiduciary standard, which doesn't seem quite as rigorous, and FINRA, some of the FINRA executives, I believe, saying that historically, I mean for years now, saying that advisors and broker-dealers should adhere to a best interest standard. Do you think that there's a chance that a uniform standard of care could come out of this for not only qualified money, but personal and corporate and other accounts?
I mean, my personal opinion is that ideally that would be the best thing for the industry, because it would be much easier to supervise one level of compliance, to educate the brokers for one duty, and to advise the clients of what the exact standards were for all their accounts, as opposed to varying standards in various accounts. Brad, what do you think?
I have to say I'm not optimistic that we will necessarily get all of those harmonized in a way that everyone's happy with in the next 18 months. That's a pretty tall order. That said, I agree that there would be some real benefit to taking away some of these silos that we've built up, where we have securities regulation, we have SEC regulation, FINRA regulation, state insurance regulation, you know, banking regulation. All of those, and ERISA applies on top of all those. I mean, there's some products where you could be subject simultaneously to four different regulatory regimes, or possibly even more. And that's not necessarily an efficient system to begin with. So I think it would make sense to change that. I don't know if I believe this rule will slow down enough for all of those other things to come to success. That said, I do think there's going to be a real effort at coordination, at least between the SEC and DOL, and I think that's beneficial. But I do think we also have some concerns about not leaving out the insurance part of this, where we have, you know, insurance-regulated products that aren't securities that this rule applies to. We need to have some way to bring parity in how all of these are treated so that we don't get a fix with the SEC that doesn't help the insurance part of this marketplace, for example.
Yeah. Well, let's conclude the formal part of the program here. And we've received more written questions in advance of this call than we ever have in the past. So let's jump on those. And then after that, we'll open it up for whatever remaining time there is. We'll open it up to calls and questions. But Brad, the first written question was, and you've already addressed this, at least partially, but the question is, I hear there is a bill to stop the fiduciary rule. Is that correct? You want to just highlight that?
Sure, yeah. There's several bills to stop the fiduciary rule. Some of them simply stop it and then say this is something that should be handled by the Securities and Exchange Commission, not DOL, so they approach it more from that perspective. There's others that stop the fiduciary rule and instead replace it with a new federal law fiduciary standard in ERISA and the code, and then approach it from that direction. As I said earlier, I think several of those are marching through the House of Representatives and have gotten to the floor in one case, have gotten through committee in a couple of cases. I think the House could pass several different forms of regulation of law here if they wanted to. I think it's going to be much more difficult to get something through the Senate, where you have to have 60 votes to cut off the debate to proceed to a vote on the bill. So, in effect, you have to have 60 votes to get most legislation through, and that's difficult to see happening on an issue as controversial as this. So that's why I think ultimately this is going to be resolved by regulation rather than legislation, but there's certainly a role Congress is playing here in keeping the pressure on DOL to address this issue, And there are members of Congress who are very interested in fixing some of the problems they perceive with this rule. So it's, you know, I don't want to portray it as something that couldn't happen. It is possible legislation could make it all the way through the House and the Senate. But there's definitely work being done in Congress to try to address it. And that's, you know, one of the potential tracks for change.
Okay, I'll handle the next question, which is under some broker-dealer RIA arrangements, the institutional share class of a mutual fund is not available, and there is revenue sharing that does not offset client costs, as in most ERISA arrangements. How should this be addressed? First, I would say that revenue sharing is not per se a bad thing. That if the money, at least from a legal perspective, if the money is taken and used for the benefit of the participant or the IRA owner, the revenue sharing is permissible, or if it is offset on a dollar-for-dollar basis against any fees of a fiduciary that caused or recommended that investment, that's permissible. But what is impermissible under these rules, generally speaking, is for an advisor to receive both a fee and then revenue sharing or 12b1 fees or other payments on top of that. For discretionary managed accounts, that is impermissible now. For non-discretionary advised accounts, during the transition period, BICE, the best interest contract exemption, creates a easier to use exemption, which is that the total compensation has to be reasonable. It cannot exceed a reasonable amount. Having said that, I think there will be a trend towards institutional share classes. Sometimes people call them R6 shares. Other people are calling them clean shares. But I think we're going to see, as a development to adjust to these new rules, an acceleration of mutual fund families adopting clean shares, where there's no revenue sharing, no 12b1 fees, no payments to advisors or service providers affiliated with the IRA or plan. So I do think, to the extent that there aren't clean shares now, there will be in the future. But if you are getting third-party payments like revenue sharing during the transition period, and you're giving non-discretionary investment advice to a planner and IRA, make sure that your total compensation is reasonable if you're or offset on a dollar-for-dollar basis. There isn't another way around it. You could pay it over into the plan for the benefit of the plan or the IRA. Brad, let me jump back.
Just to add to that, Fred, one other thing, which is that is one of the benefits of the transition period is we don't have to have achieved perfection in level fees. As Fred said, as long as your fees are reasonable, the transition period BIC exemption allows you, and it's non-discretionary advice, if you can use the BIC exemption, it would allow you to not have to use to receive, for example, revenue sharing as a form of compensation. And that is an important thing to be aware of, because I think some people have gotten confused about which provisions apply January 1 versus which apply now. And for right now, that is permissible.
You know, Brad, all along the way we've talked about the transition rules without really clarifying exactly what it is. I know many of you all know, but for those who may not, the main exemption is the best interest contract exemption, and called BICE or BIC. The only requirement is that the advisor adhere to the best interest standard adhere to the impartial conduct standards. There are three impartial conduct standards: the best interest standard of care, no more than reasonable compensation, and no materially misleading statements. All you have to do is adhere to that. And there are no other conditions for non-discretionary investment advice during the transition period. So it's pretty easy. Brad, let me turn back to you. I'm going to read two questions because they're so similar, and let's get your input. The first question is, does the DOL truly understand the impact on the industry and fiduciary rule on startup or smaller accounts? The second is, can you speak to the relevance to the small and micro plan market under $5 million and under $1 million? Brad?
Yeah, so there's really been no question. The data that we've seen already is showing that it's becoming more expensive to get advice in general, and it's becoming harder for small account balances and small plans to get advice in general. One of the things that this comment period is going to do is gather up empirical data that the department can use to explain why the academic predictions it made back in April of 16 in the Obama administration, which said basically that stuff wouldn't happen, was wrong, and use that to explain why they're changing some of these policies and show what actually happened. So I think there is a harmful effect at the smaller end of the market. This is where I always throw in a personal anecdote. Fortunately, this isn't all my retirement savings, but among my retirement accounts, I have a small balance IRA. I received a notice from my IRA provider that I can't get advice in that account anymore, and I need to look at changing it to an advisory account or something else. But where it is right now, I'm going to get no more advice, and I'm not allowed to put in any new contributions. So that's an effect this rule has had, and literally millions such notices went out to people who had transaction-based IRAs, as I have. So there is a real effect there. And the Trump administration, I think, is concerned about that effect and believes that it is happening and needs to be addressed, more so than the Obama administration did. So I think there will be that. In terms of the plan market, I think that's where we're seeing some of the biggest changes, because it's been more likely that smaller plans have either not had an advisor or have had a non-fiduciary advisor. And under these new rules, it's very difficult to have a non-fiduciary advisor. In essence, if they're giving advice, they're going to become a fiduciary. So we've had to see those plans go through changes, you know, get new service agreements, find out what's going on with the advisor they currently have, decide whether they have to do an RFP, if that advisor is not going to be a fiduciary in the future and therefore is, you know, changing whether they're going to serve them at all. There's a corresponding effect in the small plan market, much as we've seen in the small IRA market. So there's a real issue there, and it's one I think the department's going to look at very closely in its review.
Yeah, I think the fiduciary problem has been solved a little more easily in the small plan market, because the small plan is still a lot more than a small IRA. At least in the, you know, working with broker dealers on advising them, it's been much less of a problem than in the large plan, than in the IRA market. And part of the reason is that they're saying, the broker dealers are saying to their advisors, you have to work with platforms that have platform fiduciaries that will select the investments, unless their advisors already have a book of business of retirement plans. And most of the record keepers, I think, are coming out with solutions where they all have platform fiduciaries now.
One thing we should throw in there, which we've mentioned in the past but I think is worth repeating, if any of you on this call were previously non-fiduciary advisors to plans and have now become fiduciaries, that does trigger a 408B2 disclosure notice change. It probably is addressed by changing your service agreements, but it's something that people need to be aware of. And as they do make modifications, if the change is the registered rep is now going to be a fiduciary, which isn't, of course, how everyone's approaching it, it does carry with it those changes in disclosure obligations.
That's a great point. And in two ways. One is it's a change disclosure, and you need to get it out there, I think, within 30 to 60 days of June 9th, so the time is running fast on it. The other is for new disclosures going forward, you're going to have to revise your regular disclosure. So one is a change disclosure. The other is your full disclosure. The next question is incentives and clubs during the transition period. Keep in mind that during the transition period, advisors and their firms only have to comply with the impartial conduct standards, the three standards. You would think, because that's what the rule says, that that's the end of it. But I think for incentives and clubs, that's not the case, because the Department of Labor has said in two places that they expect that the firms, the financial institutions, the broker dealer or the RIA, will have policies and procedures in place, supervision, to preclude or to ensure that advisors don't make recommendations that aren't in the best interest of the investor, so they sort of fold it into the best interest standard, because of the incentives. And the types of incentives that particularly bother me are recruiting incentives, where the payoff, there's a big payoff at the end. On the other hand, if you have a recruiting incentive for, let's say, an advisor, the firm says, we'll recruit you, we'll pay you a $100,000 bonus, we'll forgive it 20% a year for 5 years, as a, you know, start off as a loan, and then forgive it. Well, there's no incentive to make any recommendations there. It's just a recruiting incentive. That's fine. But if it, but if the recruiting incentive is particularly, if it's backloaded and if it's heavy on the retention of business or the addition of qualified money to the business, I mean, it doesn't have to specify qualified, but if there's an element that could encourage rollovers or certain types of recommendations and to qualified money, then yeah, that could be a problem. Another is a bonus arrangement with large breakpoints. That is, if you hit a higher level, all of a sudden you get enough money in addition that might incent you. Or if it has a waterfall effect, you hit a higher level of production and that increased percentage goes all the way back to the first dollars. All of those are areas where that the DOL has identified in the past as being particularly troublesome to them. And so if I were going to have policies and procedures as a starting point, I would focus on those issues. And I do think they're necessary based on the DOL guidance I mentioned. Sandy, do you want to add anything to the incentives and clubs discussion?
Well, in addition to that, right before the April, the first April 10th date, there was guidance from the DOL on the recruitment bonuses and the back end portion of the recruitment bonuses. And you'll remember there was a rush within the marketplace to revise the types of recruitment bonuses that were coming in place, because oftentimes they did have back-end components. She received part of the incentive for coming over in the front end, and then if you brought over business, you received it as a back-end bonus. But there was that sort of rush to change agreements during that period of time. In addition to that, oftentimes in brokerage firms, there are incentives for the larger producers to increase the assets under management and to increase the revenues, and they come in the form of titles or clubs or trips. And that's still an issue in the transition period as to, because there isn't usually a distinction between non-qualified money and qualified money in those types of arrangements. It's what's the assets under management and what is your revenue? And brokers tend to have a significant amount of assets under management as retirement assets under management. So the issue about what is counted for those types of incentive programs to trigger the threshold is still significant.
Yeah, and then, this is Brad. Let me jump in on that as well, just to say, and all of this is even more blurred and confused than it was before, because the guidance we're talking about on all of the restrictions on compensation and recruitment and all that is from October of 16, put out by the Obama administration, and was predicated on the assumption that the full BIC exemption would apply on April 10th. Now, of course, we have a transition period where a very different BIC exemption applies. We have a different administration, and we don't actually have any guidance that clearly says which parts apply to which BIC exemption when. So do all those recruitment things apply now in the transition period, or do they apply on January 1? I think for safety reasons and litigation risk mitigation reasons, you need to treat it as applying now. But I do think there's actually some question, and DOL should have resolved these ambiguities and has been requested to do so but hasn't, about what guidance actually applies when and to which type of exemption. I thought I'd throw that in there because there's a lot of ambiguity left that we still have to work through, and this is a great example of that.
We have two more pre-submitted questions, and then we're going to be out of time to take call-in questions. I apologize for that. We'll try to time that a little better next time. But let's go to the last two pre-submitted questions, or submit some questions to us now. We'll deal with them next time. The first of the remaining two is, what effect might the new rules have on selling books of business? Is this impacted by the transition period? But generally speaking, these rules only apply if they could incent, if there's compensation for a recommendation made to an investor. So for the selling advisor, there's no investment recommendation, I don't think. I don't see one in there that is being made. So for the selling advisor, unless I'm missing something, I think you're okay. For the buying advisor, if it's at a different firm, then they're going to have to recommend that all those IRAs and plans transfer over to them, which are fiduciary recommendations, and they're going to have to do that consistent with the best interest standard of care. So that could diminish the value of the sold book of business, or not.
So
I'm just saying that.
In the broker-dealer world, generally the selling of books are not going from one firm to the other. So, you know, you often see it in terms of retirement. One broker will retire, and his book of business will pass to another broker who has longer tenure in the industry to come, and he receives some compensation for a period of 5 years or less on that book of business. He can get it all at once, or he can get it over a period of time. And if the book of business is valued based upon what the assets were in the book of business at the time the retiring or departing broker leaves, then there's no incentive really because it's past action. So he's not now incentive to give bad advice to get a better book of business. The establishment of the price of the book or the value of the book has already happened. It's historical. If, however, there's some component in the residual payouts over the five-year period that has to do with how the assets are being valued on an ongoing basis, like he's getting a particular percentage of the assets on a present value as he's going forward, then there might be some incentive. Now, he's not allowed to give advice once he retires. So, you know, the advice part is sort of cut out. So hypothetically, that should be fine. But the broker who's getting the book of business and he's giving away part of the commissions on the book of business, one could argue that he might have an incentive to increase the value of the book so that when he gives away a percentage of it to the departing broker, he still has a large percent. So I think it takes a little bit more consideration.
Yeah, the difference between where it's a separate financial institution and the same financial institution, which is what Sandy was pointing out, is where it's the same financial institution, the IRAs or the plans are effectively customers of the financial institution, not the individual advisor. So you don't have that recommendation to transfer issue. But yes, there's so many possible permutations that we can't consider them all. But generally speaking, if the selling advisor sells and retires and isn't involved in the transition process, no recommendations are made, then even there, a certain amount of engagement can be involved, but unfortunately, we don't have time to get into that level of detail. The last question is, what should plan sponsors be doing now to fulfill their fiduciary oversights? I would say, and then Brad, I'd love your thoughts, the focus on these rules from a plan sponsor perspective is to know every conflict of interest, not only by your fiduciary providers, but by your non-fiduciary providers, and to prudently evaluate them. That means that there has to be some tough questions asked. For example, if it's a fiduciary advisor making recommendations, but where there's a conflict of interest, that fiduciary advisor will probably be relying on the best interest contract exemption. In that case, the plan sponsor needs to know that and evaluate whether that's acceptable to the plan sponsor. Is the plan sponsor satisfied that the conditions of BICE are adequate to protect the participants? That is a separate evaluation. BICE just lets the advisor off the hook. It doesn't necessarily let the plan sponsor, the plan fiduciaries, off the hook in terms of their fiduciary responsibility. Brad?
Yeah, I would say this is one of those times where there's been kind of a unique event in the marketplace that should trigger a review of your service arrangements with some of your key providers, especially your advisor, kind of first and most obviously. And especially if you had a non-fiduciary advisor before who was nonetheless giving you investment recommendations, that's going to have to change. Either they're going to become fiduciaries or those recommendations are going to come from somebody else other than that person. So you need to know what's going on there. You should ask your advisor, you know, is this rule changing our relationship? If so, how? Do we need a new service agreement? Think to yourself also, is this the time for an RFP? It's important to note also, though, that if you have an existing fiduciary advisor, that isn't automatically changing. That relationship was already essentially compliant. So in particular, I think you need to focus on it where you had a non-fiduciary advisor before. We've also seen changes to record-keeping agreements resulting from this, to sort of what's available on the platform, to how education services are being provided. So it's a good time to talk to your service providers in that area as well. Basically, this rule is sort of a triggering event for taking another look at those arrangements so that you can show that you considered it, and as Fred says, that you found out whatever issues you needed to determine whether the plan needed to take an action. You want to have something in the file, something in the file that shows we as the committee thought about this stuff and then did X. Even if X is no change, you want to show that you considered it in light of this new situation.
That's a good point. Yeah, document it. Well, we're out of time, and we appreciate everybody being on the call. So, Jim, why don't you wrap it up and let us know what's ahead?
Certainly. Thanks, Fred. And on behalf of Natixis Global Asset Management, I want to thank everyone for calling in today. I personally want to thank Brad and Fred for their insight. And Sandy, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your expertise with us. Certainly appreciate it. Please mark your calendars for October 12th. That will be our next session. And I hope everyone has a wonderful summer. And with that, Kayla, I'll turn it back to you to end the call. Thanks so much.
That concludes today's conference. We thank you for your participation.